Happy New Year and welcome to First Thursday, the monthly podcast from Labor Relations Information System. My name is Rick Polson, and I'll be your host for the next hour or so as we discuss recent developments in the world of public safety labor relations. This month, we're going to kick off the bright and shiny new year by revisiting a very, very big legislative initiative and a very big legislative win from 2024 that we discussed in December. We'll also check in on inflation, the CPI, and percentage raises that we're seeing in public safety land in 2025. And finally, we'll take a look at two recent cases that highlight the importance of procedural protections in discipline cases. All that and a check-in on all things LRS when we return. So stick around and welcome to First Thursday.
Labor Relations Information System has two important seminars coming up. First off, we'll be returning to Nashville on March 28th for our Collective Bargaining for Public Safety Personnel Training. It will feature topics like preparing for negotiations, messaging, and political action, hot topics in negotiations, contract ratification and implementation, and ability to pay. On June 18th, we'll be conducting our flagship seminar, The Rights of Police Officers, in Las Vegas. We'll cover disciplinary procedure, just cause for discipline, fair pay rights for police officers, as well as other subjects. Visit our website at lris.com/seminars for more information.
First up, some housekeeping. Sorry for the late podcast this month. It turns out that I got sick. Me and everybody else on the East Coast got sick over the holidays. And so I learned that you cannot record a podcast when you do not have a voice. So live and learn for Rick. But hopefully we'll be able to muddle through it this month and see where it goes. So what's going on with LRIS? Just wanted to give you an update. Webinars and seminars, man, that's what's happening. We have a webinar coming up January 22nd. It's going to be our first webinar of the year, and that's going to answer a question I get all the time from groups that are prepping for bargaining. You know, I get to go all over the country and help folks, police, fire, and corrections groups in preparing for and engaging in bargaining. The question I always get is, where's the money, man? How can we find the money? And so what we're going to do is on our first webinar of 2025, we're going to explore the employer's ability to pay. And I'll be joined on that webinar by a labor economist named Dr. Jeremy Krimmel. And Dr. Krimmel and I will walk through the processes that we use to essentially take the financial temperature of public employers as part of the bargaining process. And we're going to talk about that more in detail at our bargaining seminar in March. But this is just a little taste of that stuff. That'll be a one-hour live webinar at 1 p.m. Eastern, 10 a.m. Pacific on January 22nd. Check it out at lris.com, webinars. If you want to see us in person, you can head on out to Vegas in early February for our annual Union Leadership Seminar. That'll be at the Horseshoe in the Paris in Las Vegas from February 5 to 7, and that's where you'll hear from actual public safety union leaders, not lawyers, about their successful approaches to running their unions. How they engage in bargaining, how they engage in PR, messaging, all of that good stuff. It's a really, really interesting seminar every year. Still time to sign up for that one. And if you can't meet us there, why don't you come on over in the eastern part of the country to Nashville, because we're going to be in Nashville March 26th through 28th for our collective bargaining seminar. That's for both union and management folks. Lots of times we have groups from the same place. They'll send some union and some management people, and we take you through the entire bargaining process, soup to nuts. And those discussions are led by negotiators on both the union and the management side. So we get both perspectives. It's always a very interesting thing. And if you're scheduling out further, June 18th to 20th is our annual Rights of Police Seminar in Las Vegas. If you want info on any of these events or to check out the entire 2025 calendar, please check us out at lris.com. Okay, so let's kick off the podcast with a discussion, or a continuation really of a discussion that we had when we were last together in December. And back then we discussed the prospects of the somewhat controversial Social Security Fairness Act, which at that time was sitting in the United States Senate with 62 co-sponsors and near universal support. But nobody, and I mean nobody, had any idea if it would actually pass. And then, you know, if you want to catch up, go listen to that pod. I can give you all the, you know, the ins and outs of what the bill did and some of the risks. And I was shocked when on December 21st, we got our answer to the question and the Senate voted to pass the legislation. Again, by an overwhelming margin, President Biden signed it into law actually earlier this week. So the Social Security Fairness Act has passed. That is a major, major win for around 2.8 million public sector retirees and their families, with a price tag of, around 200 billion bucks over 10 years. So yeah, how do I know it's a good improvement? Because it costs that much. It's a really big deal. And congratulations to the FOP and the IFF and the Teamsters and AFSCME and all of the big public sector unions who worked really hard for, not kidding, for 40 years to get this thing done, a big win. And I got to tell you, in my heart of hearts, I did not think this would happen. I really didn't think it would pass. I don't know whether it's just hard-earned cynicism or what, but I thought the politicians would just let the clock run out on the legislative session and they'd string everybody along for another legislative session, get those contributions and glad hand you and not get anything done. But I was wrong. And so what a wonderful Christmas present that was and a New Year present for public safety retirees. Now, we did talk about the bill last month and, what it does. So if you missed that pod and you want a primer on the act itself, you might want to pause here, go back and listen to December. What I want to talk about this month is what the bill actually does. I've got a lot of questions about it, mostly from retirees. What does this mean? And what do the retirees want to know who are affected by this? How much am I getting, right? That's what they want to know. And the unions that I work with also have questions about, what does this actually mean for us, at the bargaining table? Are our people affected? If so, how? And then what does that mean for bargaining? And so I want to talk a little bit about dollars and cents. What the bill actually means for retirees and for surviving spouses. And so, in other words, what does $200 billion in new costs actually look like when you spread it out over 2.8 million retirees? The super short answer for people who have to move on to something else is probably about $7,000 a year for a retiree, right? That's a lot of co-pays, right? That's a big, big deal. So it's a big win. Where do I come up with that number? That's what I want to talk about. It does require a little bit of math. Sorry about that, but bear with me. As we discussed last month, Social Security is basically a defined benefit pension program administered by the federal government and funded by workers and employers via withholding of tax. That's pretty much how it works. As is usually the case, right, with anything coming from the federal government, the benefit calculation is ridiculously complex. You may be working in a place where it's, we have a multiplier of 2.5%. We multiply that by years of service and voila. Or it's just, we have a 50% pension or a 60%. It doesn't work that way with Social Security, believe me. How do I know this? I actually went and read it and figured out, because I never had a look before, how Social Security is calculated. So I don't know whether I'm pleased to report or I'm embarrassed to report that when I was sick, I spent a lot of time farting around on Social Security's website so that I could understand how benefits are calculated. So I took one for the team. Let me explain it to you. In most, pension systems, right, the monthly benefits expressed as a percentage of your final salary, right? Lots of variations. What percentage, for example, 50, 60, et cetera. Some systems will be a flat percentage of final salary. Others will arrive at the percentage via a multiplier times years of service, right? A 2.5% multiplier after 20 years gets you a 50% pension, something along those lines, right? But 50% of what, right, is the other part of that equation. What's the salary we're basing this calculation on? And different systems include different elements of salary into pensional compensation. Overtime's a really good example of this. Some places include overtime. Some don't include it at all. Some include it, but cap it at, 10% of salary or something along those lines. And that's all going to vary based on what your state or your local pension statute or ordinance says, or what you've negotiated into your collective bargaining agreement. And how do we measure the final salary? Is it based on your final month, your final year? Is it averaged out over two, three, four, 5 years. It just depends on the system. And there are some systems where it's like your final week, and you can imagine how that can be abused and has been abused. There's others where it's your final 10 years or something like that, which is a really long time to measure and can be problematic. Well, how does Social Security do it, right? That's the question. Well, Social Security benefits are calculated based on what they call the worker's averaged indexed monthly earnings. It's your AIME. I'm going to call it your AIME, okay, over a 35-year period. 35 years, right? That's a long measuring period. If you don't have 35 years in the system, you get a zero, for the years that you haven't worked. So if you have 25 years in the system, you get 10 zeros, up to 35, and they include that in the average, right? So that'll bring down your number, right? But it's not that bad. You would say normally the longer the pension, the measuring period is, the lower the pension benefit's going to be, because hopefully 5 years ago you made less than you make today, right? And if we average that out, your salary isn't really going to reflect what it is today. Social Security gets around that. And imagine a 35-year measuring period, you get screwed. Social Security gets around that by indexing salary over the 35 years. They index it in order to account for inflation. They publish the index, and they adjust those old wages, from 30 years ago, so that your benefit is meaningful. And you can dig into that process if you want by heading over to ssa.gov in your spare time. Now, once Social Security measures your AIME, or they identify your AIME, they then apply a series of percentages to that average salary to determine what they call your primary insurance amount. It's your PIA. Doesn't mean pain in the ass, although you may very well be. But it's called a PIA, and it is a PIA to calculate, honestly. But here's the formula. Once the administration identifies your AIME, they multiply the first, and it's a monthly benefit. So they do your average, they divide by 12, they get the monthly benefit. So of that monthly benefit, they multiply the first $1,174 by 90%. Okay. Then they multiply the next $5,904 by 32%. And just to make it more complicated, if there's anything left over, they multiply that overage by 15%. They add up those three numbers, and you get your PIA, your primary insurance amount. That's how they calculate your benefit. So here's an example. The annual wage used by Social Security as their national wage index in 2024 is $66,621. So we're just going to use that. We divide that by 12 months. It gives us an average monthly benefit, an AIME of all fives. It's $5,555. All right, that's what we're working with. So the first 1,174 of that 5555, we take that, we multiply that by 90%. That gives us $1,054. Great, set that to the side. The remaining amount is $4,398. We multiply that by 32%. That gives us $1,407. Set that aside. So you add the 1407 to the 1054, and that gives you 2461. That's the AIME. That's the monthly. It's not the AIME. I'm confused. That's the monthly benefit. Multiply it by 12. It's about $29,500 a year. So if you were a person, civilian, worked, paid into Social Security, that's what your benefit would be based on that salary, about 30 grand a year. What's the problem? Well, here was the problem. Here's how the windfall elimination program hurt retired cops and firefighters. So all of those numbers, if all of those numbers I just mentioned were the same, right? You had the same 66 grand average wage, and that's either earned kind of during your career as a second job or after retirement. It doesn't really matter, right? But if you retired from a public sector job, right, and you receive a pension from that job, and you didn't contribute into Social Security as part of that job, if you had it from outside work, this is where it kicks in. What's going to happen is Social Security is going to reduce your benefit by using a lower multiplier for that first $1,174 of your AIME, right? So for everybody else in the country, it's 90%. Right, so 90% of that 1174 is going to get you $1,000. It's 1,054. That's what everybody else gets. If you're a windfall elimination retiree if you're somebody who falls into this category, you had a government pension, that multiplier is lower and it can go, can be as low as 40%. And basically from, that's the number that's going to hit most people. And how do we get to 40%? Well, the multiplier falls below 90% by 5% for each year below 30 that you participated in Social Security. So if you have 20 or fewer years in Social Security, which is going to be pretty typical for our people, you know, that's going to be the calculation that's going to be a lot lower. And that's going to be a 40% multiplier. So if we go back and do the same calculation, right, that original retiree got basically about $2,400 a month, you know, about $30,000 a year in Social Security. Well, what are they going to do if they're one of our retirees subject to the windfall elimination provision? So instead of 90% of that first $1,174, we'll use 40. What's that give us? $470, not $1,054. Right, the remaining 4398 stays at 32%, equaling 1407. We add that to the 470, we get a monthly benefit of 1877, or around 225 a year. And that's compared to the 295 benefit anyone else would receive. So with that example, which is probably the most common example, we're talking about a monthly difference of $584, right? So an annual difference of about $7,000. That's a very, very big deal. It's going to make a big difference in the lives of, you know, retired police officers and firefighters and correction officers who've been impacted by that windfall elimination provision. So what's the big fuss about? It's about that, $7,000 a year for retirees. That's a big improvement. So congratulations to them and congratulations to the unions who fought long and hard for the improvement. And congratulations and credit is due to the elected officials who supported it. So thank you all for your service. We hope you enjoy a long and healthy retirement. Okay, well, speaking of Social Security, I thought we may as well talk about wages as we enter the new year and what's something that Social Security does every year, you know, some years bigger than others for its recipients. Well, Social Security adjusts its benefits. They provide cost of living adjustments. you know, not every public sector pension includes a COLA. I represent many groups that do. I represent lots of groups that don't. And again, that's going to be a function usually of state statute, local ordinance, bargaining, maybe a mix of all three. But it's really, really important. And, you know, when we're trying to take the temperature of, you know, what's necessary for a cost of living, I tend to look to start with anyway, Social Security. And Social Security, it's not exactly like a one size fits all deal. But it's a pretty good indicator of what's going on with inflation at the national level. It gets a lot of press, and everybody, it almost sets the tone sometimes in people's expectations about what's happening with inflation. And so, you know, if you're, again, if you're interested in this sort of thing, or if you're just sick and have nothing else to do, you can go to the Social Security Administration's website. They disclose on their website its history of COLAs, and they've been doing this since 1975. You want to get there, just Google Social Security COLA history, and you'll find it easily enough. And that'll show you every percentage COLA that Social Security has given, you know, for the last 50 years, pretty much. And, you know, you see different numbers, and what that shows us really is how inflation changes over time. You know, nothing lasts forever. When you're in the throes of high inflation, you think it's never going to end. When inflation is, you know, non-existent or sitting around 1%, you think the party's never going to stop. But, you know, when we take a step back and look at things over time, I think it gives us a helpful perspective. And let me give you an example. And this is just based on Social Security's site. So for the four-year period from, you know, 1979 through 1982, right, period of high inflation, annual Social Security COLAs averaged 10.7% a year. Right? So over that four-year period, the COLAs that recipients were getting were, you know, averaged out to 10.7%. That's a big deal, right? Inflation was crazy back then. And if you go back, if you can, if you have access to this stuff, and you look at your percentage raises of your group, if you had a contract in the late 70s or early 80s, and you try to recreate your raise history. And if you haven't done that, it's very useful to do that and to maintain that. It's a very useful tool in bargaining. What you're going to see is that raises are going to reflect that. The raises that your groups received late 70s, especially early 80s, would have been especially robust. And the reason for that is that wage growth tracks inflation, right? Which makes sense when you think about it. Now, wage growth, does wage growth cause inflation? Or does inflation cause wage growth? We'll leave that to the economists, and the honest ones will tell you they really don't know. What we do know is there's a correlation between inflation and wage growth, and wages generally grow, I would say, about 1.5% higher than inflation if you look at that over an extended period of time. You know, so there is a relationship. If we fast forward 20 years, let's see the difference. Instead of 79 to 82, we go to 99 to 2002. Social Security's average COLA was 2.5%, right? So not 10.7%. And you know, that reflects, right? Inflation was a lot lower back then. And what we're going to see is we don't see those giant wage increases that we saw in the early 80s. Around 99 through 2002, we saw, and that's close enough, you can go back and look at your raises and see what was going on there. They're probably, you know, in the threes and fours. Remember, 2002, you know, we had a post-September 11th bump. We saw that in bargaining. So what happens in raises doesn't always reflect solely what's going on in the economy. There are always other factors to consider. And I'd think that that kind of pro-public safety, that appreciation for the sacrifices of public safety personnel in the wake of September 11th gave an additional bump to raises back there. And you were looking at fours, fives, you know, back then. Wait, unfortunately, I can remember way back then and bargaining contracts back then. Let's go forward another 10 years. Just keep the experiment going. 2009 to 2012, Social Security's four-year average COLA was 1.3 1/4%, right? A heck of a lot different. And so depending on what snapshot in time you look at, we're going to see different things happening with inflation. We're going to see different things happening with Social Security COLAs that reflect that. And we're going to see at the bargaining table, you know, different results. 2009 to 2012, were we seeing really big raises in that period of time? No. What else was going on? And what was part of the overall concern in that period of time? Well, that was the Great Recession, you know, which really hit the public sector, 2010, 11, 12. And, you know, if you guys were at the table back then, you remember the unions were playing a lot of defense, especially on pensions and things like that. And so you're going to see probably lower raises in your history. What does that mean today? Well, you know, we had a period of some pretty big Social Security COLAs over the last few years, reflecting the spike of inflation in 21 and 22. But that's tamed a little bit, right? And so Social Security's 2025 COLA is 2.5%. And so what does that mean for us, you know, at the table? Well, we know wages grow a little faster than inflation. And Social Security gives us a one-size-fits-all kind of look at, you know, how costs are raising. You know, if you subscribe to our newsletter, we break that down. We break the CPI down into regions so we can kind of dial in more specifically. Excuse me. But what that tells us is that, you know, there's not as much upward pressure on raises if we solely look at inflation as inflation starts to tame. What's the big difference here, though, right now that leads me to believe that raises are going to stay high? And actually, we track these things. Wages have stayed high. Just like what was happening from 2009 to 2002, or like really after September 11th, so 2002, 3, et cetera, we had this other factor, right, that led towards higher raises. We have the same thing happening now, you know, and that's the recruiting and retention crisis. Absolutely, you know, hasn't gone away, still a big, big issue. And that combined with inflation, even though inflation is taming, is still creating a pretty significant updraft on raises. What do I mean by that? And I'll show you that raises have come down a little bit, but not down that much. You know, if you subscribe to the newsletter, we track and we report average raises for police and fire, for law enforcement and fire. We'll do it every quarter or so in the newsletter. 2023, the average police raise, and this is based on lots of different sources that we track, but it's internally consistent. The average police raise that we tracked in 2023 was 5.6%, and fire was 4.6%. Really high numbers, right? Reflecting what we were seeing with respect to inflation. 2024, it came down a little bit, right? Police at 4.3, fire at 4.0. For 2025, based on what we have, you know, we're still tracking pretty strong raises. Police raises are around 4% for 2025 and fire at 4.3. So fire a little higher than police. And so, you know, we're seeing the raises come down, but they're not coming down dramatically. And I think that that reflects probably to a large extent what we're seeing with recruiting and retention. So, you know, look, we were talking about Social Security and COLAs and thought it might be interesting to take a look at this and check in when we take the temperature of things. Another area where inflation is going to be reflected is going to be in the bottom lines of our government employers. And that's why we don't just look at what the members are feeling. We have to look at, hey, can the employer, how's the employer doing, right? Can the employer pay for these raises that we think are warranted? That's a second step of the process. You want to join us for the webinar in January? That's great. You want to join us at our bargaining seminar? That's where we really dig into those details. But thought the numbers would be helpful. Feel free to dig in as you're making your bargaining plan for the year. Okay, we're back. Part three. We're going to talk about the cases. And there's two cases, and this is a complete left turn from what we've been talking about. These are two like really specific procedure discipline cases. And you know, they're both in the newsletter, the January newsletter this month. So you know, dig in and you can pull the cases and read them. And we highlighted them because you know, we get so many questions about procedure. And you know, at our discipline seminar in November, where we have labor and management folks, we work really hard to make sure that people understand the appropriate procedures, because you just never want to win or lose a case on procedure. You want to try to get to the merits, right? Should somebody be disciplined? And if so, you know, what's the appropriate measure? You know, we shouldn't be on the union side. You know, no one really wants to win a case on procedure. If somebody screwed up, they should be disciplined. And on the management side, you sure don't want to lose one. So we have two cases that address procedural concerns. One comes out of L.A., and this case is Bedard versus City of Los Angeles. It's a decision out of the California Court of Appeals. And the site is 2024 Westlaw 463-4930. And man, we're not done with these COVID cases yet. This is a COVID case. It's a COVID vaccine mandate case. You know, we still have them. I guess COVID still exists. I probably had COVID last week. But let's go back in time and talk about this one. And so City of Los Angeles declares an emergency back in March 2020 in response to COVID. Got it. The following year, right, in August of 2021, you know, after we had arrived at a vaccine and we had vaccines becoming prevalent, the city adopted essentially a vaccine mandate. You know, they adopted an ordinance that required employees to be vaccinated against COVID-19. You could request an exemption. And if you didn't either get vaccinated or request and receive an exemption, you'd be subject to what they called appropriate and immediate corrective action up to and including termination. You know, and if you were subject to an exemption, there'd be additional hurdles. You'd have to be tested every week. And in LA, you had to pay for the test. So the employer wasn't going to cover that. The city negotiated with the Police Protective League regarding the consequences of noncompliance, you know, the typical impact bargaining. And they didn't get to a negotiated outcome. And ultimately, in the fall, the city implemented its last, best, and final offer. And it basically, it was, if you're either vaccinated, you have an exemption, or we're going to fire your ass. And, you know, once you get with the program, you know, if you can prove that you're vaccinated, we'll let you seek reemployment, but you got to comply. And, you know, that was what they implemented, and they put the word out to the troops. And they did that in October. And so they released a memo to all city departments saying, we're implementing our offer. You're going to have to get vaccinated. You have to sign a notice to confirm that you've received this notice, you know, within 24 hours or 48 hours. And if you refuse to sign the notice, not necessarily that you agree with the policy, but that you knew about the policy and you know about this mandate, they're going to put you off duty without pay. We've got Board of Rights proceedings, discipline, you know, protections in place. But, you know, they're pretty serious about implementing this. Editorial note, I had no involvement in the LA case and look forward to speaking with folks and hearing their input, you know, on this. But crappy overreaction by the employer. You know, lots of employers understanding the risks with vaccine mandates, they could achieve political outcomes without really harming employees too much, and the employers that kind of drank the Kool-Aid, so to speak, messed up. And I would say LA is one of them. But we've got this police officer. Her name's Janine Bedard. She worked for the department for a long time, like 20 years. And she was not going to get vaccinated, And basically, her child had been vaccinated and had a pretty serious reaction to the vaccine. Which happened. And so Officer Bedard went through all that concern. And when it came to her getting vaccinated, she said, no way, I'm not doing that. I saw what happened to my child. Fortunately, everything is okay, but I'm not going to subject myself to that risk. She received a notice in November, a notice of mandatory COVID-19 vax policy requirements. And they said, you have to sign a statement confirming that you're going to be fully vaccinated by December 18th. 2021. December 18th is Keith Richards' birthday, if you want meaningless information. And in the interim, she'd be required to she's not vaccinated. She's going to have to go through weekly testing and pay for it herself at her own cost. She didn't sign it. She refused it. She said, I'm not getting vaccinated. I'm not doing it. And so what did? They basically fired her. They temporarily relieved her from duty effective November 17th. Pending a hearing before their internal disciplinary board of rights. Now, remember, the deadline was December 18th, but they put this officer off on November 17th. Keep that in mind. at the discipline hearing, ultimately, the board found that Officer Bedard failed to comply with the ordinance and that she was lawfully terminated, right? This was the rule, and she didn't comply with the rule, and the department was able to discipline her. The issue in her case, and the issue that the board found, was that she wasn't given any time to properly respond before the police department of the city put her out in November. And specifically, the board determined that, there wasn't sufficient time to respond to the charge. Generally, you're going to have 30 days to respond to a charge to make sure that you have an opportunity to consult with an attorney, put your best foot forward. Officer Bedard wasn't provided any of that information. So she was ordered, she stayed fired, but the board ordered the police department to pay her what amounted to seven months of back pay, because the board's decision wasn't issued until the summer of 22. The police department appealed that. They said, we agree that we should have the right to fire her, but, they challenged the back pay. Because what we disciplined her for wasn't not getting vaccinated. We disciplined her because she refused to sign the notice acknowledging it. That was what, really caused the discipline, and this December 18th timeline was not meaningful. So the Court of Appeals found that the city had cause to terminate Officer Bedard. The court also found that the city screwed up, that the city did not allow or provide Officer Bedard an appropriate hearing prior to the disciplinary action. In California, we're going to call that a Skelly hearing. And the court said that the constitutional infirmity of the disciplinary procedures used in the present case, right, was the imposition of discipline before affording the employee notice of the reasons for the punitive action and an opportunity to respond. This infirmity is not corrected until the employee has been given an opportunity to present their arguments to the authority initially imposing discipline. And under the procedures applied to Officer Bedard, the constitutional vice existed until the time the board rendered its decision. Prior to that time, the discipline imposed was invalid. And so the court said, absolutely, back pay was appropriate for that seven-month period, even though the city thought it shouldn't have been paid. There was one final issue that the court addressed. And Officer Bedard argued on appeal that because of the significant constitutional violation in her case, she should be, as a remedy for the due process violation, she shouldn't just be limited to back pay, but all of the discipline, right, should be voided and she should be awarded her job. The court did not go so far with Officer Bedard on that. The board determined that discipline was warranted. We agree that you didn't have ample time to prepare your case, and we're going to give you 6 months' pay as a result of that. But it doesn't overcome our ability to actually visit the merits of the discipline. And this comes up a lot, you know, when people think that just because there's a procedural violation, they're going to, you know, quote unquote, win their case. Well, no, there can be remedies for procedural violations. And sometimes, depending on the nature of the remedy, if there was an investigatory violation that that caused evidence to be considered that shouldn't have, that might, you know, wind up voiding the discipline itself. But it's not always the case. And so the interesting thing out of the Bedard case and why we talked about it is that, yep, sometimes the remedy is just money. So in this case, an officer was fired. She stayed fired, but she got 7 months of back pay because the employer went about it the wrong way. Our next case takes us across the country to the Commonwealth of Virginia. And the site is Shiflett versus Hill, and it's record number 1357-23-4, Lexus 582, and it's a decision from Virginia's Court of Appeals issued recently. Now, this comes out of Fairfax County in Northern Virginia, and it involves an officer, police officer, by the name of Wesley Shiflett, and it's a shooting case. Officer Shiflett becomes involved in an officer-involved shooting in Tyson's Corner. And he shoots and kills a suspect named Timothy McCree Johnson. The dispute in that case was whether or not Officer Shiflett's testimony was accurate. The officer said, basically, I'm chasing Johnson. Johnson stops, turns, drops in a defensive stance, reaches for the waistband. You know what happens next, right? You know, I'm doing my job, and I discharge my weapon. The police department investigates. We don't need to get into the merits of that if the testimony is accurate, right? Sounds like a pretty good defense, but we're not going to get into the merits. About a month later, department investigates, and it lets Officer Shiflett know he's being fired. And they describe the justification for the discipline that Shiflett's conduct, not just at the incident, but his inconsistent articulation and lack of forthcoming answers to questions in totality have failed to meet the expected standards required, blah, 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 right? So they investigated. They don't believe Shiflett's version of events, whether there's body cam footage, what other witness testimonies. I don't know the rest of the investigation in this case, but they don't buy what the particular officer said in this particular case. A week later, the department followed up and they gave a more detailed memo identifying specific reasons. You know, here's what you did wrong. The officer filed a grievance. In Fairfax County at the time, there was a statutory grievance procedure as part of the county's personnel regulations. So think about in places where you have grievance arbitration. It's analogous to a grievance arbitration, but it flows from ordinance as opposed to a collective bargaining agreement. It's interesting. And one of the arguments that Officer Shiflett raised was that he was not provided proper notice or justification for his termination, right? He was fired, and then a week after he was fired, he was provided a memo saying, basically, here's why we fired you. Got that a little bit in reverse. And so one of the arguments that Shiflett raised was that he was not provided with ample information before his essentially Loudermill hearing. He had requested all of the information the department had regarding the investigation so that he could prepare an explanation. He wasn't provided with any of that. He raised all of these arguments in a grievance hearing before the county executive. And there are provisions in the ordinance that set forth certain procedural requirements for the grievance procedure. In Virginia, there also is essentially a state bill of rights that sets forth additional rights. This is where it gets confusing. The county ordinance has certain procedural requirements that are different from, in some instances overlapping, but pretty much different from other procedural protections contained in Virginia's Police Bill of Rights. Shiflett, in his appeal, raised a whole host of alleged procedural violations, including violations of rights afforded under the state law. And the county executive, who essentially is, for our purposes, the arbitrator in this case, rejected those and said, I'm limited to whether or not there are any procedural violations related to this ordinance, not your other procedural arguments, whether they stem from our state Bill of Rights or whether they stem from the Constitution. And so the arbitrator essentially refused to consider those things and decided the case based on the merits. Shifflet appeals this to a Virginia's Court of Appeals. First to the Circuit Court, loses, and then appeals to Virginia's State Court of Appeals, and was unsuccessful. And so the question in that case is, what type of procedural infirmities was the arbitrator or the county executive in this lower proceeding obligated to consider? And the Court of Appeals had an interesting take on this. Let me quote from the decision. Quote, it's true that an employee who asserts a grievance is entitled not only to certain statutory protections, you know, spelled out in the grievance process, but also to certain constitutional protections. But it is well established that the elaborate statutory grievance procedures instituted by the General Assembly more than satisfy the minimal requirements of due process. Thus, a grievant can seek immediate review of whether a party has failed to comply with all substantial procedural requirements of the grievance procedure without just cause. In other words, the chief administrative officer may consider only whether the parties have substantially complied with the procedural requirements listed in the grievance procedure, and if not, whether there was just cause to excuse the failure. Interesting. So the court goes on to basically say that the statutory process is all that matters here. The statutory process picked up essentially the constitutional rights and other statutory rights under the Bill of Rights. The court says here, Shifflet's arguments that the department violated his constitutional and statutory rights by terminating him, and that his termination also violated the department's personnel policies, are all complaints about the merits of his termination. They're not about the process that the department has followed in reviewing his complaints. So because they're outside of the bounds of the grievance procedure, they're also beyond the chief administrative officer's consideration. Very, very interesting. And that particular matter was about whether it was limited to whether the county executive followed the procedural requirements of their ordinance. And so that may have played a factor in this case. There's another case apparently focused solely on the merits. And so interesting outcome. Not sure that I agree with the Court of Appeals, but pretty particular facts in Virginia. The reason we included it in the newsletter and the reason we're talking about it is because, again, you know, as a practitioner, oftentimes, you know, we are faced with a decision of where are we going to raise these arguments if there's a Loudermill violation? Are we going to raise it in the grievance process? Is there another avenue where we could raise it? Or is there another avenue where we are required to raise an argument? In this case in Virginia, actually, since the argument here from the employer side or what the court said is, you know, the statute dictates certain places where you bring certain arguments. And, you know, we're not going to go any further than the jurisdiction that's provided in the ordinance. And so it really stands for this proposition. If you got to know the rules where you are, you have to have a clear understanding of what, you know, not only what the contract requires, but what your civil servants ordinance or your Bill of Rights ordinance has to say about where you are to bring claims. Because in this particular case, what we never want to see, right, is a situation where you have procedural infirmities that would be sufficient to nullify a termination, let's say. You know, there's a really significant procedural violation that, you know, should nullify all of the discipline. The employee raises those arguments in the wrong forum, and then as a result, they're not reinstated. And so both of these, you know, cases, the California case and the Virginia case, you talk about procedure, and they really stand for, one, you have to know the rules where you are, and two, you know, be really thoughtful about, you know, these procedural arguments. Don't just throw them out there because you're looking for any argument you want to make, but understand, you know, what the possible outcomes are before you raise them. Okay, that's the pod. Two Social Security issues, two discipline cases, and my voice held out. How about it? I hope everybody has a great month of January. Come on back. We will have a new pod drop on the first Thursday of February, I promise, and I will talk to you then. Bye-bye.